Disclaimer. The views and opinions you hear expressed by the participants in the show are not the views of AnimeNewsNetwork.com. Enjoy the show. Everybody, welcome to Ancast. I'm Zach Birchie. Very special show today. We are honored and excited to have these two guests on the show. One is a returning champion. She's co-author of the Anime Encyclopedia, and you can find her basically anywhere people are talking about anime. The beloved Helen McCarthy is here. Helen, thanks for coming back.
That's my pleasure, Zach. Thank you.
And joining us for the first time, and we've been trying to get this guy on the show for a while, even though he apparently never got our invites. Also co-author of the Anime Encyclopedia, which is out now, and a million other things. Again, you can find him basically anywhere people are talking about anime. It's Jonathan Clements. Jonathan, thank you so much for coming on.
Hi, Zach. I think you've been inviting the wrong Jonathan Clements all this time.
You know, you said that, and it's possible.
That guy from the Washington Post who writes about financial advice is sitting there going, why do they want me to talk about cartoons again?
Man, I wish he would, though. It'd be a great show. So you guys have this behemoth, like monster book out. It's the third edition of the Anime Encyclopedia, which the first edition came out when?
2001.
Okay.
Yeah, we were 7 days after September the 11th. We were in Atlanta for the launch. No one was that happy.
Yeah. Wow, that's bad timing. So now you're on the third edition, and... I guess let's start from the beginning on this one. How did you get it in your heads to make this book? And I guess what was your sort of goal in producing it the first time around?
For me, I wanted this book when I first found out about anime, when I first started to watch anime. I thought, where is there a great big book that tells me about all these people that make it and a little bit about the stories and tells me all the stuff that there is to get out there? Where can I find this book? And I couldn't find it. So I thought, oh, well, better write it. And I started trying to write it and failed completely because at the time there was no anime market and just kept pushing and pushing and pushing. Founded a magazine, luckily coincided with the release of Akira in the UK, helped to generate that market, then managed to write my first book. And 20 years on, managed to actually get to the position where we could persuade people that the Anime Encyclopedia was a good thing. Now, this may sound like a sad story, but in fact, it was a very useful thing to have to wait that long because it enabled Jonathan to get out short trousers.
Yeah, what she said.
So, but, I mean, essentially, I wouldn't have written anything about anime if I'd been able to get the books that I wanted. And it still amazes me that relatively few people, apart from the two of us, write books about anime and publish books about anime and look at things like who's directing what, who's doing what, where are the good writers coming through, how does the industry work, like Jonathan's most recent book. I would retire in a heartbeat if people would stop bitching about the books other people write and start writing their own.
Yeah, that's a glove thrown.
Wow, okay. So
now's your chance, Zach.
Oh God, no thanks. So basically you were sort of filling a void. You felt like something like this didn't exist. Obviously it really didn't.
I think the best possible books that anyone can write are the ones they want to read themselves that no one else has done.
Right.
And that's all of my favorite books that I've written myself have been the ones that no one else would write for me.
Yeah, I mean, it's something that drives you, this idea that, yeah, I'd like that book. There must be that book. And at some point you think, all right, I'll do it. My book on Miyazaki came from the same place. My book on Tezuka came from the same place. And there's a whole long line of books that I want to write that nobody else is doing, just stacking up behind me.
Right, right. And so what, like, if you could boil down kind of the mission statement of the Anime Encyclopedia, like, finish the sentence, like, this book is supposed to be what?
That's a good way to finish the sentence, I think. But no, really, the mission statement has kind of changed over time, and I'm sure Jonathan will have quite a bit to say on this. But when it started out, it was simply, there is no information about anime in English available to a wider public than the 50 people at a time who read APAs or who are members of Cartoon Fantasy Organization chapters. What we need is a book. And its mission statement was just get a book out there that starts the discussion, that opens the door, that begins to say it's not just about, you know, whether or not you think X heroine or Y hero is cool. It's about how people work on this thing. And my thought from the beginning was, once we get something out there that begins to say this, it will open a debate. So the mission statement was just, A, give me the book I want, give me what I want, give me it now or in 20 years. B, let's get some work started here. Let's give people something to argue with, to fight with, to debate with, to add to. And, you know, that was it, pure and simple, in the beginning.
Now, I think everybody listening is now aware that when Zach asked for a concise and single sentence reply, he wasn't going to get one out of Helen. And he's not going to get one out of me either, because I'm afraid. What then happened with the first edition is that we did the big list of all the stuff that there was, that we knew of, and basically stated our position. As every book is, it's a statement of everything we know at the time the book is printed. But then we actually wanted to start working with the material that was there. People had said, well, I wish we knew what all the anime was. And we said, well, okay, there's a big list of it. And they said, well, I wish we knew which ones we should be watching. I wish we knew which ones were science fiction that was worth seeing. I wish we knew, where's the fantasy? And so we started doing the thematic entries for the second edition. So we didn't just make it bigger. We also started linking the stuff together and writing these essays or columns or whatever you want to call them about various aspects of anime history. I started trying to tell the history of anime from a number of different perspectives. So history of anime as told through censorship, or the history of anime as told through translation practices, and so on. I did one about the history of anime as told through technology, which turned into my doctoral thesis, which turned into another book. By the time of the second edition, we were really trying to work with what we had and look at the data that we had amassed and try and do things with it. And I'm very proud of the thematic entries that do that sort of thing, you know, on subjects like censorship or stop motion, or I wish we'd done one on art house animation after Jasper Sharp's review last week.
Fourth edition.
We'll do art house animation and Jasper will shut up.
And I'm sure that, you know, there are things about that approach that has changed our approach, because I know when we started talking about thematic entries and you said, why don't you do this, or we could do with one on this, and I picked up a couple of them, it changed the way I was working with those anime, and it changed the way I looked at anime. And of course that enabled us to go on to add little biographical bits and pieces, although there is a whole biographical encyclopedia of anime waiting to be written.
I was thinking about doing it, and I just couldn't be bothered. I thought, we'll just shove it into this one, let's make this book bigger rather than you know, have a competing volume.
Wow, well, that worked, didn't it? 4.6 pounds and...
yeah, 1.1 million words later, and yes. You know, we still forgot to do that guy who did the thing.
Yeah.
I mean, do you think that over time, because, you know, in the last maybe 5 years, I would say, I'm sure I'll get corrected on that, we've seen the rise of the Sakuga fan, which is sort of a term for people who are fans that are particularly interested in, like, production credits and, like, which animator did these keyframes in this episode. And do you think, like, have you seen a rise in interest in people learning deep, like, diving deep into production credits and knowing the personalities and the talent that make these shows in similar to how people are interested in, like, the way American film is made? I mean, have you noticed that, and do you think that influenced the book at all?
People do it in fairly narrow slices. There are still very few people with the breadth and the gravitas, the sheer weight of, say, a Ben Ettinger.
I was going to say Ben Ettinger, yeah.
Yeah. But you do find that people come up with this in their own little niche, their own narrow cast, as it were. There's an artist who interests them, or a studio who interests them, or a group of people who interests them, and they run with that. And that's really fun. But the thing we've got to remember about this fandom is that staying with it is aberrant. Staying with it is very unusual. You get fans who are so focused because they are at the age when they focus on everything in intense detail. Mm-hmm. And those who stay with the fandom for long enough will turn into, we hope, more Ettingers, more incredibly valuable, wise, gifted resources. But not many of them do.
I personally am not artistically qualified to spot the work of particular animators. I can spot certain character designers sometimes, but I just don't know enough about the way the art style works to look for that sort of thing. And I have noticed a couple of people who are clearly coming at things from an artistic or an animation, you know, point of view. But I've also noticed it's worth bearing in mind that when we started writing about anime, not when we started writing on the first book, but back in, when was it, Helen? 1991, when you did Anime UK.
Yeah. 1992, when you walked through the door having picked up a copy in Japan.
Back then, it was unusual to even know who a director was of a particular animated show. And so it was the early magazines in America, like Animag, Helen Morton, name some others I've forgotten. Protoculture Addicts in Canada and Anime UK in Britain that actually started to say to look at the credits and work out who these people were. And the commercial sector as well was doing it. They were saying, well, okay, we've got this thing called Ninja Scroll and it's by Yoshiaki Kawajiri. Then maybe this Kawajiri guy is someone we should be looking at. Maybe we should buy the other stuff that he's done. But it was a very slow process, and it makes me feel very old but also very proud to know that I was there at the beginning when people didn't even know who animated directors were. Mm-hmm. And now people will talk about their favorite writers. They will talk about their favorite animators and their favorite composers as well, which is a very big area for anime fandom, as you know. And that's something that we've seen happen within the last 20 years. I mean, it really has been that exponential. We've gone from it's a cartoon, we think it's from Japan, to the kind of list that ANN has of, you know, the entire staff and cast and crew.
And all the publicists, don't forget, because very much still, many, even very well-respected websites are in the hands of the companies as to what they put out. And so you see listings for anime where the entire publicity crew is listed, but you don't get all the key animators. Yeah. And that can be very uneven. That can be really difficult to research. And it's one of the challenges that we have when we're researching is how much information do you actually get? How much is there?
And who do we trust as well? There was one company, which I won't know, but we all know who it is, who they were desperate to have one of their titles listed as an anime made in the year 2000 because they wanted to be a 21st century product. And I know 2000 isn't in the beginning of the 21st century, but it's got a 2 at the front, so it looks good. And it really annoyed them that, and we were trying to get an image for the second edition, and they said, well, you can't have an image unless you change the date because you said it was released in 1999. And I said, well, I went to see it at the cinema in 1999. I got the ticket here if you want me to hold it up to the camera. And they genuinely tried to steer us into basically lying about when the film was released. And they tried to use image rights as a way of you know, holding that over our head. And we said, well, we're not going to put an image from your film in our encyclopedia if you're going to make us lie about it. I mean, what's the point?
Right. Yeah, I mean, one of the things that probably many fans don't realize is that the image in the Japanese animation business is a weapon.
Mm.
It's a bribe, or it's a threat, or it's a bludgeon. But the control of images is one of the things, I think, that makes many Japanese magazines about anime quite lightweight rather than the deep, discussive tomes we tended to think they were back in the day
but back when New Type USA was just getting off the ground, and people saying, oh, isn't it going to be great? New Type's going to be in English. And I said, I'm not quite sure you're going to say that once you can read it. I speak as a former member of staff of New Type, but I was always, you know, I can say this now, I don't work for them, they can't fire me. I was always more of a fan of Animage than New Type, and I always thought the information that was in Animage was of far higher quality. But New Type had the glossy pictures, and New Type had the posh looking spreads. So fandom in general always worked on the assumption that New Type was the place for the, you know, really cool in-depth articles, which New Type did have fantastic data, and that was something that I was, you know, very happy to make use of. We were working on the first edition of the Anime Encyclopedia when New Type USA kicked off, and one of the reasons that I encouraged them to do the TV listings in the American edition was so that I wouldn't have to translate them myself when working on the Anime Encyclopedia. I've confessed all now. There you go.
We had a terrific stat, because my other half keeps everything, and we had a wonderful stack of those little annual New Type data guides. Do you remember those, Jonathan?
I still have them on my shelf here.
Steve had accumulated, and he punted them all over to Jonathan to translate for the first edition. That was a hell of a job.
I can't remember what the question was now, Zach, but do you consider that to be an answer of sufficient length?
You know what? Yes.
Okay.
I'm perfectly happy with that. Although it's my understanding that Animage is the same as Newtype is.
Animage, I think, has gone downhill a little bit. I mean, the Animage I'm talking about is from, you know, 10, 15 years ago now.
Okay, yeah.
You're thinking before Toshio Suzuki went into anime full-time, you mean?
Yes, back when Toshio Suzuki was the editor. That's something else that he's managed to achieve. Of course, they'll put someone else in charge whose name is Suzuki, like he's Gardner or something. I don't know.
Right, yeah. But in terms of just being basically a collection of press releases and glossy pictures, yeah.
Like, yeah, I mean, that is one of the problems that you have with, you know, Newtype used to have this thing called Anime Express, which was basically a collection of press releases. Mm-hmm. And something that I found very frustrating, and I still find incredibly frustrating now, and I bet you do as well, Zach, because you have to deal with exactly the same material, is that they managed to make every anime show sound the same.
Yeah.
And I remember taking the press release for Evangelion and the press release for Escaflowne and putting them side by side and saying, this is basically the same show. What they're trying to sell me is, you know, boy with robot gets mysterious girl. And this is no help at all. Mm. It doesn't even tell you who the protagonist is in each case. And that makes it very difficult. You have to kind of, when you're dealing with Japanese synopses, or sometimes we have to, it's very difficult to kind of negotiate your way around this very formulaic way they have of explaining how a show works, particularly today when some shows are less about plot and more about a series of memes that are just shuffling around naming their names.
In that particular instance, though, I do have to say I can't blame them for trying to sell Earth Maiden Arjuna to people as anything other than what it actually is.
Oh, goodness, yes. If we sold people what it actually was, very few industries would survive.
Yeah. We had some terrible fights with back with Central Park Media.
Oh, God, yeah.
Over Slayers. Because I ran an article in Manga Max magazine, the second issue of Manga Max, about Slayers, and we translated a whole bunch of material out of some of their art books and some of their interviews, and we basically said it was a show for kids. I think we said it was for 10 and 11-year-olds, because that's what they were pitching it as. And Central Park Media were very angry about that. They said, this is for teens. This is for 15 and 16-year-olds. I said, well, I've got the director here saying it's not. You know, what do you want to do about it?
Directors.
Yes, but I mean,
what do they know?
The anime business was desperately trying to hit certain demographics, and it's tried over the years to hit different demographics, and so you get very basic anime, which are either twisted to sell to children, or they get 15s to try and sell them to adults, and you know, or they're hacked about with a knife to try and make them fit particular censorship regimes and particular national ideas of what a cartoon should be. So it can, you know, create this huge mess of trying to work out what the original was like and to what degree it's been transformed in the English language or any other language.
Right. Yeah. So back in like 2001, obviously, you know, it's interesting to follow the genesis of this book, because it, in effect, It being what it is and having been produced over the time that it has been produced, it's effectively your experience working on it is a chronicle of the anime industry for the last 15 years, which have been
absolutely
the most interesting 15 years in anime history, maybe. Especially in the
that's
US.
A bold statement.
Well, just in terms of industry moving, like changes to the industry and how things have happened. And how we get anime now. And I mean, 15 years ago, if you'd have told us all, hey, you can watch everything right when it airs,
yeah,
we would have lost our mind and said, like, you are full of shit 100%. Like, no way is that going to be the future. And it is.
Back in the 1980s, Noboru Ishiguro wrote his memoirs, looking back on what he thought was the end of his career. And he said, I see this terrible day coming up ahead when there will be 30 anime a week on television.
Yeah.
And I just can't imagine what kind of hell that would be. And he lived to see 100 anime a week on television.
Yeah. There are 30 anime a week on television in Belgium in the 1990s, early 2000s. But it is an interesting question as to how we now conceive the anime industry, because increasingly, and particularly in America, the anime industry is conceived of as being Japanese American industry and not purely a Japanese industry. There is a whole area of expectation and critical assessment around how American fans consume anime and how the American market looks at anime. One of the criticisms that come up in the encyclopedia, which to an extent is justified, is how many things have received releases since we started writing, but for various reasons, including running out of time and our poor publishers' readers tearing their eyeballs out with spoons, haven't got the little asterisk next to it. Things have changed so incredibly in the last 20 years that just keeping up with the pace of that change in Japan is near impossible. And keeping up with it when you move it to America is getting crazy.
Certainly in 2001, it was still the norm for something not to be available in English. And it was an exception if something was. And these days, that's completely reversed, as you know. So we're dealing with simulcasts and sometimes even simuldubs of shows, so that the transformation is incredibly fast. And there is this kind of, there's like a double sonic boom effect when anime are released. There's people who are watching it on Crunchyroll or other streaming sites. And then 18 months later, the DVD release limps along.
Right.
And so you have this issue in fandom where people are cosplaying as characters that the DVD kids have never even heard of, if they are legal. And so I certainly, you know, when Attack on Titan came out, I was getting really worked up about people cosplaying as Attack on Titan characters. Like, you shouldn't know what this series is yet. And they still have just watched it on Crunchyroll, and they're legal now.
Information can't be contained.
Yeah, so I mean, but and that's made our life particularly difficult because the average anime fan still is only a fan for about 18 months to 2 years. So I mean, I know that's hard for your listeners to believe, because most of them think they're going to be anime fans for life, but many of them will be gone within 24 months, and so you get these people who are absolutely passionate about a show that. I mean, since we handed the book in, there have been two seasons or three seasons have come and gone of shows that have been the center of someone's world and have been the most important thing for a particular anime fan. And they've spent 12, 13 weeks of their life just absolutely immersed in this thing and loving it to death. And then they're annoyed that it's not in the anime encyclopedia.
Yeah. So 13 weeks when you're in high school is a huge, huge commitment.
That's a long time in gay years. Yeah.
It's longer than most of your relationships, apart from those with your parents and immediate family.
Right.
It's huge. The other interesting thing, actually, about this acceleration is the way it impacts licensing.
Mm.
That whole shifting frame of something that gets licensed and the company goes bust and somebody picks it up and somebody else picks it up, or nobody knows where the license is, so nobody picks it up. It can be incredibly difficult, even in normal circumstances, to sort out licensing rights for anime. And when you start taking into account the vast number and the speed of American releases and the number of different platforms, it gets even sillier.
And the Japanese aren't helping at the moment by splitting Blu-ray and DVD and selling the same thing to different companies. That's caused all kinds of backstabbing and hand-wringing in the British industry at the moment.
Well, now the big bugaboo is which streaming rights do you get? Are you getting domestic? Are you getting global? Like, the streaming rights are now like the most valuable piece of that contract, or at least that's what I'm told. So, yeah, of course, things have changed. The me of 10 years ago wouldn't have been able to conceive what we're looking at now in this industry. But in terms of producing a book where you're basically listing shows, what challenges have the speed of information that we currently have presented to you while you're trying to produce this book?
I don't know if it's the speed of information so much as the increasing volume of information that is a challenge, because one of the things that you learn to accept when you're writing about a live topic, whether it's a live person or a live industry, is that at the point at which you stop, you can be 100% correct, and 24 hours later, you can be 80% wrong.
Yeah.
You kind of have to accept that when you're writing about anything that's changing as fast as we are changing, as anime is changing. Yeah. And so that's not such an issue for me. It doesn't faze me if somebody says, ha, well, you've got the English license all wrong because it's in here, or you've said that there's no English license, or even, you know, the second or third or fourth season doesn't tie in with what you're saying about this guy back here in the first season. That's kind of acceptable. But the volume of it, the sheer relentless volume of it is awe-inspiring. It's like, I imagine it's how primitive man felt standing in front of a glacier and looking at it and thinking, Oh, shit, it's moving.
I'm not doing a Glacier Encyclopedia. You're on your own.
That's okay. I quite fancy doing that. But, yeah, it's the volume. It's the speed.
And this has been true for a longer time than people think as well. I mean, I'm looking at the introduction here where I actually went and hunted down the number of minutes of new animation that were produced in Japan in the year 2006. And in 2006, it was 135,530 minutes of wow. new animation produced in Japan.
Right.
It's dipped a little bit since then, but it's still a lot of stuff turning up.
How has it gone? It's gone down since then? It's like 38 new shows every season for a year, four times a year.
But the length of the shows is slowly decreasing, though, isn't it, Zach? You know that. Right. I mean, one of the things I noticed, there are quite a few of shows going straight to cell phone now that turn out to be 3-4 minutes long.
Yeah.
But also, I was at the Anime Japan thing in Japan in Tokyo last week. I saw one show that was being advertised called Triage X, which looks fantastically ridiculous. And probably is going to get all kinds of people into trouble. But it's 10 episodes long.
Yeah.
They're selling it as a TV show, and they're offering 10 episodes plus an OAV. So our concept that anime for the last 20 or 30 years, even if it's on video, has tried to emulate the patterns of TV release. And the patterns of TV release have been a 12 or 13 episode core of 25-minute episodes, which would be expanded to 30 minutes with the addition of advertising. And we'll play to that. We'll have an eye catch in the middle to make it look as if there's going to be an ad break, even on an OAV. That kind of thing is changing now. And I think although there are more shows being released, I think gradually we are falling below the 22-minute barrier now, and they're getting shorter, because I think many viewers have stopped caring about this television paradigm completely, because television is not something they even watch anymore.
They pick up their advertising online. They pick up their advertising in other ways. And the advertising money is following them increasingly, following them to you know, wherever they go, online, on the air, everywhere. Mm. So I think that fall is pretty natural. But also, of course, the whole cell phone thing I find fascinating, because there's some great short anime out there. There's some great, very, very short anime out there. And it works so much better in the lifestyle of modern youth, as one might call it, because 4 minutes is about the attention span you have if you're running from school to a part-time job to an after-school club to a hobby. It fits the niche. And the way we've moved from social to solitary consumption and from longer forms to shorter forms is matching the movement in society as a whole, not just Japanese society, away from mum being at home and the kids coming home in the evening and dad getting home from work and everybody watching TV, away from everybody watching Sazae-san on Sunday even, to grabbing your favourite thing on your smartphone. That's bound to make a change.
It changes the way that anime is being monetized as well. I mean, one of the things that I'm very excited about in the new edition is the advertising and sponsorship entry, where we talk at length about context integration, which is, it's not just product placement, which is where someone would drink a can of Coke and wave it about in front of you when they did it. It would be the taking of a product that someone's trying to sell you and jamming it into the plot of the show itself so that it's fundamental to that plot. And the most obvious example is Gundam, of course, where they're trying to sell you a different giant robot every week and they're trying to dram as many of them as possible in there. But I can see context integration really taking over in anime now, because if you're using product placement or context integration for a show, you don't need to sell it to someone. The advertisers are paying for it. So you don't care if it's being ripped off. You don't care if it's being torrented. You would almost encourage it, almost.
Right.
So I can see that changing the way that anime works as well. And something that Helen mentioned made me also remember that conventions have changed, not just in terms of size, but it used to be you go to a convention to watch anime. I don't think that's true anymore.
No, of course not.
Well, you still see a few people in the anime rooms, but they're usually just hanging out with friends.
Mm-hmm. Or lost.
Or it's a good place to sit if you're really exhausted and you couldn't afford a room.
Yeah.
Oh, I remember that.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, the idea of going to a convention to get media that you wouldn't have access to otherwise is just an antiquated notion at this point. Media access is no longer the gatekeeper. Like, that's not, like, so, you know, if you have, like, the super elite otaku back in the day, in the 90s, it was the super elite guys were the ones who, or self-proclaimed anyway, had access. They had all the tapes, you know, they were the ones with the shows. Now that went away, and so actually kind of the Sakuga thing is sort of the new gatekeeper. Like, that's the new way people decide to categorize themselves as elite fans, is by being really into that stuff. So I guess the next edition of your book needs to be, like, you know, more focused on the Sakuga.
Oh, something to look forward to, Greg.
Because one thing that academia does quite well, certainly American academia does quite well, is focus on the fans.
Sure.
Is focus on the consumers. I think, however inadequately I do it, I'd rather stay focused on the thing itself.
Yeah, sure. No, that's a good idea. The second edition of this came out, it was in the middle 2000s, like
2006.
Yeah.
So right before the bubble burst really, really badly in 2007-ish, at least in America. I have no idea how that bubble bursting impacted in the UK.
It burst everywhere.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It
impacted us quite seriously because America had already taken over most of our industry at that stage.
Right.
The independent British companies that were dubbing and even in some cases subtitling in the 1990s and just before the first edition came out had mostly gone by 2006.
This may be weird to believe, but what Helen's referring to is that in 1995, 30% of all English language anime came out of London.
Mm.
Right.
Not just London, but one street in London where Kiseki and Manga Entertainment both had their offices.
And substantial amount came out of Bangor in North Wales.
Oh, let's not remember that experiment. But that was where ADV Films had their office in Britain because, you know, ADV are from Texas, and so their idea of a 400-mile commute to work in London was you know, that's a long walk in Texas. Mm. So
nobody walks in Texas.
Oh, yeah, I forget. But anyway, sorry, I interrupted, Helen. Sorry, carry on.
No, not at all. You're interrupting beautifully, so you go on. Talk a little bit, because I love to hear you talk about that era of the industry, because at that point we were involved in production as well, you much more than me, because you were embedded in a number of studios as a kind of writing and directorial mole.
Indeed, I was the writing mole. but the thing is that 1995, 30% of Anglophone production was coming out of London. By 1998 or 1999, that had almost entirely disappeared. And I think by 2002, there were no new dubs being assembled in Britain. And to be honest, I can't remember any subs either.
No.
There are quite a few individual subs now that get done in Britain or are done as a co-edition deal with an Australian company. But basically the British industry, particularly the British dubbing industry, went from being worth a third of everything to being nothing, to being completely nothing. So when the slump came, the collapse of the American business, the British were just waiting for American dole by this point. There was nothing in place to actually put their own stuff together. So when the American industry, you know, sneezed, everybody caught a cold.
Mm.
Yeah, that's true. How did that crash? Did that crash impact? Did it impact sales of the book? I mean, how did it color?
No,
not at all.
What impacted sales of the book was a guy in India scanning the entire thing into a computer and then running off PDFs and giving them away to people. Apart from that, the 2006 edition did very well for us, and it was enough for Stonebridge, the publishers, to authorize a third edition. It took us a long while to get round to it because, you know, everyone has to be in the same place, everyone has to agree, and Peter Goodman, who is the publisher at Stonebridge, who you know, puts his money behind this every time, he spent a long time kind of walking around the concept of the encyclopedia and trying to work out how he could possibly do it. In the terms of the third edition, we really had to wait for print-on-demand technology to catch up.
Mm.
To the extent where we could, because I think Helen is with me on this one, I insist on a paper edition. I don't want it to be just digital. I want it to be an edifice that you can point at and on the shelf and say, that's what anime is. That's how big the anime business is. I don't want it to be a cluster of electrons and you can only tell how big it is by, you know, counting your megabytes. And Peter said, well, fine, we can do a book, but we have to find a way that it won't collapse under the weight of its own spine. Mm-hmm. And we have to find a way of being able to charge people money for it. And in fact, I don't think Peter will mind if I say this. We went ahead on this third edition with the expectation on Peter's part that we would sell 100 copies of the paper edition.
Tops.
100 copies, two libraries, and then everyone else would get it on the Kindle. And actually, we've had to print 500 copies of the print of the paper edition so far. Peter's had to go back and run off a load more copies of the paper edition. And the paper edition is currently doing better than the Kindle.
Yeah, and we are delighted about that, because one thing that people very often don't realize, unless they're in the book business themselves, is that without the support of a publisher, a book this size and a book this scale just couldn't exist.
Right.
Yeah. I mean, in the case of the Anime Encyclopedia, for example, simply posting a review copy to a journalist costs $130, $120,
yeah, something like that.
Because you've got the cost of the book itself plus the postage, which is for a giant lump of, you know, anvil like this. And so it's not the kind of thing where you can just, you know, shoot off 100 copies and hope someone picks it up. You're worrying about your expenses just sending it to people to review.
Yeah, you could do it on Lulu, but it would cost you a fortune on Lulu or on one of the other self-printing platforms. Mm. And then when you've done it, you've still got the issue of it's got to be marketed, it's got to be presented.
Mm.
It, without the support of a publisher like Stonebridge that really cares about the medium and really cares about it in its context in Japan, we just would not have been able to do this book.
Which is why it makes me laugh when on the day of publication, Peter Goodman is minding his own business, checking his email, and someone emails him and says, I bought the 2006 edition of the Anime Encyclopedia. I refuse to spend $14 on this new version just because you've made a couple of corrections. And Peter was very unhappy with that. He's a very, what's the word? He's a very calm man. I've never seen him get that angry, but he did kind of lose it a bit with that one. He's saying, you've added a word count to this book that is the size of the Lord of the Rings. This is
damn
not,
straight.
It is not a couple of corrections. We've added 400,000 words to this edition.
Jonathan has corrected every one of the existing entries.
Right.
I wrote 300,000 words of new material. I have written more than many of the lauded novels that people are happily shelling out $30 for.
Yeah, so anyway, that was a bad day at the office for Peter, I think. He wasn't really pleased about that.
Dear Miss Rowling, in your latest book, he only goes to school and does magic. He's done that in every other one beforehand. Please send me all your books until he does something different.
That's excellent. So what went into this new version? When did you start? And I guess, like, can you walk us through a little bit of the process of how you even start, and like what is your process for producing something?
I've got a spreadsheet that I've been maintaining for the last 15 years of what the new show, what shows there are, and what, you know, films there are, whether or not they're available in English, what year they were released, and sources of information for them, either on my hard drive or on the web. And the first stage of any update is for me to actually try and assemble that list and bring it as far up to date as possible. On this particular edition, I then gave it all to Helen to do. I went off to correct the existing 700,000 words and to go through line by line and entry by entry, seeing if there were things to add or things that needed to be changed. And Helen went and wrote 300,000 new words, about half of which I ended up changing, about everything that had happened between 2006 and 2012, which was when I assembled the spreadsheet. And then after 2012, we fought about who got to cover what of the stuff that had come out since then.
You didn't fight very hard to cover the pornography, I have to say.
I didn't. You know what? I think you deserve that.
Thank you. It enlivens my declining years. Well, my process for this book was essentially, I had Jonathan's spreadsheet with all the new material up to 2012. I had my own notes with new material. I then dived into as many Japanese sites as I could find, picking up material, watching material. I have such good credit now with several Japanese sites that sell pornography. And I have to say that most porn sites are actually extremely useful in that while everybody on the show may be working under a pseudonym, they will usually make sure that you know the pseudonyms that everybody's working under. So you actually get better input from many, many porn sites in terms of doing the research than you do from more allegedly respectable outlets. Yeah.
There is a very, very small number of guest entries in the encyclopedia, only about half a dozen. But every now and then, someone will say, someone will volunteer some information to the extent they might as well write the entry themselves. So, for example, Fred Patton, back in 2001, this was for the first edition, he said, I've read your Giant Gorg entry and it's rubbish, so I've taken the liberty of writing my own. And he just sent it in, bless him. And that's basically the Giant Gorg entry that we have.
Yeah, absolutely. And Fred, I'm sorry that Fred doesn't write more now. I'm glad he's still writing, but he's such a wonderful resource and a truly amazing asset.
Yeah. So 2012, you decide to get the ball rolling on this. And is the intention basically like, so what is that deadline process like? Like, you have we're going to turn the book in here. When do you stop cataloging?
We didn't actually stop cataloging until the point at which we had to print.
Okay.
There were several points where we meant to stop. But then we got the opportunity to do a little bit more. We thought another week we can pile these in. Another week we can do a bit more.
Yeah, in fact, the book was supposed to go to press in, I think, October or November 2014. Mm-hmm. And so our cutoff point was probably a couple of months before that. Unfortunately, the book was delayed by a couple of months because of the sheer amount of labor involved in doing the digital ingestion for the Kindle edition and all of the links and the cross-references inside it. And that was very frustrating at the time because, as you know, 2 months is another season of anime. So that was quite irritating. But nevertheless, we were writing new entries right up until the last possible moment. Peter said, right, that's it, no more new entries. And then I realized I hadn't done Princess Kaguya. So thought we'd better put that one in, otherwise there will be trouble. I think Princess Kaguya was the last entry to go in, I think.
Yeah, well, that must have been really maybe frustrating deadline situation where you're like, okay, if we don't have this finished by September 30th, a new season is going to start 5 days after that, and then that's
exactly. We just had to live. We just had to live with that. We've been in this position before, and what we don't want to do is what we did on the first edition, which was that as a new season was approaching, I kind of panicked and wrote entries on a number of shows that I hadn't seen, based on the awful press releases that were a new type. And we have to. We can't do that. We need to speak from a position of authority. So. On this one, the new seasons came round, and I just, you just have to let it go. We'll worry about those. We'll worry about
those. We are one with the wind and snow.
Well, yeah, also, for God's sake, it doesn't have to be anime infanticide. We don't have to watch every single new thing. It's a historical book, and, if it stopped in 2011, there would still be loads of cool stuff in there. We did our best, but obviously it's very important to me that the book is a paginated paper object that you can cite page numbers from and that you can point to. And so unlike a all-digital edition, you can't just shove the latest show in when no one's looking. Although we did try, but Peter wouldn't let us.
We do our best. And with digital printing, it is easier to do updates, but our problem now is that the size of the book is such that we are virtually on the limit where it's possible to do it with a spine.
Right.
I think it's 1,200 pages, and we're at about 1,140, 1,136. 1,136 is the last page of the index.
Yeah, but don't forget there's all the Roman numerals at the front as well.
That's true. There are all those.
There's 24 pages of Roman numerals at the front, so basically we're at the limit of that size. But that's okay. We can do two volumes.
Yeah, I was going to say, like, that must increase the cost, though, for the publisher a substantial amount.
Yeah, although Peter's done a very... I mean, one of the things that you have with print-on-demand, of course, is that you don't have to worry about warehousing. So a book this size, if there were 6,000 copies of it sitting in a warehouse, then the rent that those books would be paying would substantially change the price of the book. They'd be double the cost they actually are. It's quite handy that we don't have to worry too much about those kind of costs, although, just shipping them to people is still hard work.
Horrendous, yeah. But it is a legacy book. It's a book that's there to say, this is what we did at this point in time, this is what we knew at this point in time. And it's wonderful that so many of the libraries that bought the first two editions are still picking it up. Right. But it's also wonderful that people are actually going out and buying it. I know people who've laid down their however many dollars it is on Amazon at the moment, or gone into a bookshop and bought it, and that is just fantastic.
That stands to reason. So since you've been doing this the last 15 years, I'm curious, in the last, I guess let's just talk about recent history, because we'd be here all day if we were to talk about all of the changes. But in terms of the content itself, like, do you have any observations on what anime is now, what it is now? Like, how would you characterize anime if you had to sort of put a button on it?
You've never been able to say what anime is.
Sure. Okay.
Can you say what art is now?
No.
Yeah, there you go. I mean, the other interesting thing is you can't even say what anime was. Yeah. And we've been reminded of that very strongly through a few new things that came through in writing the book. The first was Jonathan's fabulous forensic archaeology on the Shadow Staff, who are one of the great
staff
discoveries of this book. The other is Mole's Adventure, just turning up in a warehouse somewhere. First color anime made in Japan, virtually forgotten apart from a few references in books. And suddenly there is this gorgeous little cut paper animation that is a beautiful thing in its own right, but also rewrites the history of the medium. And right. it's things like that that mean that we cannot say we've nailed this. There's still so much to do, so much to learn. There's so much work to do about the pre-war and the wartime years. There's so much really interesting stuff buried in people's memoirs and people's biographies and autobiographies and in magazine articles, in everyday magazines, not anime magazines, but the kind of thing that, you know, grown-up people read that occasionally have a quick article about what the kids are doing. All that stuff is out there, and in fact, a good deal of it, certainly for the occupation era, is in the USA in the Gordon W. Pransch collection in Maryland. And all that research is waiting to be done. It's just thrilling. So I don't think I'll be able to say what anime is until I've done a lot more work on it.
I think there are certainly trends, though, that you can look to in the way that a lot of modern anime are being assembled.
Sure. Anime, yes.
When I say modern anime, I mean the last 5 years. I mean the last 5 or 6 years.
Yeah.
And when you look at some of the numbers and also some of the things that producers are saying, it does make me think. I mean, for example, Anime News Network did a review of the Anime Encyclopedia, which went up today as we're talking, as far as I'm aware. And there's a lot of talk in the forum about the concept of arrested development. And there were several commenters in the forum saying, you know, there's no proof of this. They're just making stuff up. If you look at the entry in the Anime Encyclopedia on kids anime, you'll see us actually quoting a producer from Gainax, a man called Hiroki Sato, who says that to his mind, the ideal anime fan is perpetually 14 years old. And he goes on to break that down into either we're talking to an audience of 14-year-olds or we're talking to an audience of adults who enjoy, you know, remembering their youth and experiencing some of the tropes and the memes of their youth. Or we're talking about people who are generally arrested development, who need in some way to be pandered to by some kind of entertainment that is avoids adult matters, shall we say. Mm-hmm. And I find that very interesting, particularly with regard to the size of the anime fan community, which is still only 112,000 people by some Japanese estimates, which is basically the size of the circulation of Newtype in Japan. I'm not talking about Bleach. I'm not talking about One Piece or Pokemon. I'm talking about the dedicated community of people who will buy the $500 box sets. And the waifus and the pillows and whatnot, which are regarded by the companies as a cash cow. And there's a great book called Otaku Marketing, which was published in 2005 by the Nomura Research Institute, which talks about all kinds of narrow casting and niche publishing, not just anime fans, but train spotters and camera enthusiasts and tourists even. But when it talks about anime, it says, you know, as far as we're concerned, we expect an anime fan of this very small niche, of the otaku niche, to be buying, to be spending about, I'm trying to do the figures in my head, about 80 or 90 American dollars a month on anime-related products, not just the shows themselves, but the dolls and the event tickets and the CDs and so on. And you can see shows being made for that audience where you are sometimes you are and people don't believe me when I say this, and they say, well, I know a show that's done 80,000 copies. That's all very well, but there are many anime shows that only have an audience big enough to fill a single cinema.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And one of the ways that modern anime, by which I mean the last 5 years, appeals to these people is to literally go on tour, to literally go to cinemas. One of the great proponents of this kind of modern distribution method is Makoto Shinkai. He's got plenty of fans. He's got thousands of fans, but he will go the extra mile. He will go from cinema to cinema selling DVDs at his cinema and signing them to turn it into an event, to actually monetize his products in that way. And so one of the things that I find very interesting about modern anime is that it's a very solipsistic and small and dwindling niche where people are paying increasingly high sums for increasingly bespoke product. I know crowdsourcing is a big issue in the anime world in the West and in Japan now, but I do think that for the otaku market, a lot of anime has been effectively crowdsourced for the last 5 years.
Yeah.
Crowdsourced in advance, if you like.
Sure, yeah. It's sort of the idea that the same 10,000 people buying Blu-rays, those people are keeping the industry afloat.
Yes. It used to be in the 1980s that you could guarantee there'd be video stores that would buy any new video release,
right,
because they were going to rent them. So you had a dedicated audience of 5,000. You knew you would sell 5,000 copies of anything, no matter how bad, because every video store would take at least one copy.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, those stores are disappearing now, and people are accessing stuff more directly. This is why streaming and simulcasting is becoming more of an issue, even in Japan, because digital access is the new cash cow. But what this means is that you have to be much more reliant on actual purchasers, not renters, but purchasers. And I think that's changed the way that some anime is put together, not necessarily for the better either. I mean, I think it's nice in some cases, and it's generated some lovely bespoke titles, like In the Forest of the Firefly's Light, for example, which was basically just shown in a single cinema for 6 months. And if you wanted to buy the DVD, you had to go to the cinema and watch it, and then they'd sell you the DVD when you were there. And that was a lovely kind of, you know, bespoke thing for them. But it also does create an awful lot of hentai and borderline hentai and gamified female characters, which I find, you know, very irritating. Obviously, there's a market for that, and that market is very small. And then that very small, and the problem is that you then have a show that only appeals to, say, 1,500 people in Japan. Literally, only 1,500 people. They call it a TV show but it's on at 2 o'clock in the morning. They don't mention that at the rights fair. And then that is sold to an American company, which is trying to sell it on Blu-ray or, you know, on DVD. Is trying to sell it to an audience, and they're hoping for Akira numbers. They're hoping for Ghibli numbers. And there's a huge disruption, a huge disconnect between the expectations of the mainstream and the expectations of this very, very small focused niche. And obviously, the big distributors are fully aware of this. But every now and then, someone new kind of blunders in and picks up something thinking he's got Akira, and actually he's got Violence Jack or something.
Now, I'm sure if Violence Jack were properly presented, I'm sure it would go down a bomb, because it's still.
I'm trying to think of the name of Zach's favorite anime. That's but I can't remember what it was now. The one that no one bought, but everyone had to invest in.
No, I can't remember what it was either. But Violence Jack, I mean, don't diss Violence Jack. It's the only thing I've ever shown that sent hardened science fiction fans fleeing, looking white faced and about to throw up from the room.
So I guess that sort of begs the question then. You guys are, you know, creating this enormous book. You're consuming, obviously, probably a tremendous amount of anime. What personally have you seen lately that you thought was worthwhile?
I keep talking about Terror and Resonance, which I really enjoyed because I like a bit of a plot, a bit of a driver, not too many fan service shots of the panty kind.
Mm-hmm.
And I just like a good basic story. Narrative always drives for me. I adore character. I like character that's really well created rather than hammered together out of a series of disconnected tropes and then stuck in with sugar icing. But To get me, a show really needs to have one of two things: either absolutely breathtaking craftsmanship in one area, or a really good story.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I have fallen in love with shows for nothing more than their ravishing art.
Mm-hmm.
That can always get me, even if the rest of the show is pretty dreadful. But what we exist for is, yes, to be personal and to be engaged and to be opinionated, but also to look at everything in balance. And I think, to be honest, that although a couple of people have rather ineptly tried to tear us a new one on some of the stuff we've said in this book, I think we've been reasonably balanced in it on the whole.
Right.
I was very excited about Shirol Bakor, but I haven't actually seen it yet. But I'm genuinely looking forward to that in a very sad way, because I'm quite hopeful it's going to bring all my nightmares to life. But the thing that I've seen relatively recently that I've been most impressed with is Fuse, Memories of a Huntress, as it's now called, because that was made as an anniversary piece to celebrate, I think, the 80th or 90th anniversary of Bungei Shunju magazine. And so, although on the surface it's, you know, just a silly thing about hunting dog demons in Edo, it is this fantastically postmodern version of a dozen different ways of storytelling. And Bungei Shunju is a literary magazine, and they've basically taken every single pulp way of telling a story for the last 100 years and tried to throw it all into a single film. It's beautifully done. Very, very clever. Very, very aware of the fact that it's a fictional story. But it manages to be a critique of the red light district of Edo, as well as being a celebration of it, as well as being a celebration of ukiyo-e prints, as well as being a celebration of kind of pulp novels like the original Hakenden. It's beautifully put together. And that was the thing that really impressed me the most. I think the director has got a future, definitely. Mm.
I haven't seen that yet, but I'm looking forward to it, particularly because I think one of my favorite early mangaka, Ippei Okamoto, he used to write for Bungei Shunju, if I remember rightly.
Oh, well, there you go.
Well, he was cool.
Yeah, I think Shirobaka is actually the new show that I would recommend to everyone my age who liked anime at some point. It
also has lots of cool stuff that's cropping up on Twitter at the moment.
Yeah, it's the finale just aired, so it's a lot of people talking about
but,
it. Right now.
Zach, have you seen animation runner Kuromi-chan?
Yeah, that's the big comparison. I think Shirobaka is a lot better.
Excellent.
Yeah, like a lot better. Like really gives you a fictionalized, dramatized picture of what it's like to do this for a living inside this particular bubble. It's very now. Like, it's very much dealing with the current production climate. Obviously, it's fictionalized, but a lot of things happen for drama's sake. But, no, that show is brilliant. So we got to get to this before I get to these Twitter questions, and it's kind of the big question that I think came up a lot in response to our review that we just posted. But I think maybe it's the most common piece of feedback you guys get producing something called the Anime Encyclopedia, which is, I mean, no offense intended, is basically painting a huge target on it in today's climate and saying, attack me for not being an educational resource in the way that each individual person perceives an educational resource. But a big criticism of your book is that it's very opinionated. It has a point of view. And a lot of people say, including, I believe, our reviewer said, well, this is disqualified as an academic resource because it has opinion in it. And I'm really curious how you guys respond to that particular criticism.
Well, they're absolutely entitled to their opinion, obviously.
Right.
Yeah. Should a review really have opinion? Shouldn't a review just kind of list what happens in something?
Well, it's a subjective.
Without spoilers, don't forget.
Without spoilers, no spoilers. I think it's kind of odd. In the case of your review that you talk about, or that Rebecca Silverman talks about, you know, how important it is to have, you know, academic context when she hasn't covered the history of anime that I wrote last year, which establishes a lot of the academic context. And when it comes to encyclopedias, this comes up every time we do the book. People complain that, you know,
it can't
too
be
much.
An encyclopedia.
It can't be an encyclopedia. That's what one guy said, but yeah, that was in Atlanta. Bless him. Ahead of this podcast, I went to get my copy of the Chambers Dictionary, and I looked Encyclopedia up, as I find myself doing once every few years, and it still says, and I quote, a work containing information on every department or on a particular department of knowledge, generally alphabetically arranged.
Mm,
it sounds like an encyclopedia to me.
Right.
Chambers. They have some questions to answer.
I went to Wiktionary. Originally, I went to Wiktionary, and they said basically the same thing. And I thought, no, I'll go to a paper book. Come on.
Right. Well, I mean,
you know, really.
Go ahead.
No, No, you go and finish, Jonathan.
Well, I was
no, that was me opening some tonic water. It wasn't actually me breathing. But yeah, but the thing is that also we, by virtue of the fact that we've been doing this for 15 years now, I think most people expect us to argue with them and to have a conversation with them. And in fact, we also argue with each other. I mean, I don't agree with everything that Helen says in the book, and she doesn't agree with everything I say. Case in point, Queen's Blade, which I think she was incredibly kind to. But I like what she said in her review, so I let it stand the way that it was. I think it's fun to argue with a book, and I think it's pretty clear what our opinions are and what our likely thoughts are. I will say that in 2001, around the time that we finished the first edition, there was a book published called The Tenchi Encyclopedia, and it had 30 pages. and some pictures of some girls, and yeah. Apparently that's an encyclopedia. That's okay. No one complained about that. They just complained about us.
I mean, I'm really happy if people have opinions. I think opinions are a very good thing. I think informed opinions are an even better thing. And one of the reasons we started to do this book, going way back, one of the reasons I wanted this book, because was that there was no information out there. What we've done is we have built the edifice of information. We have contributed massively, and I make no apology for this, and I'm very proud of it, to the baseline knowledge of anime that enables academics to do their work. We've been out there being the Indiana Joneses of the business, getting all the treasures in, and they can now sit in the museums and analyze them. And
this is a metaphor stretching far too far, but go on.
Boying, that's the elastic springing back. But when people get angry about things in the book, my answer is usually the same. I'm glad that you've engaged with it enough to get so wound up about it. Read back and check that you actually have engaged with what it says rather than just what you think it says. And go and write your own book. For God's sake, go and write your own book. I want to see your book. I want to see your take on this. I want to see what you would write about something you think is so important that you're going to attack somebody else over it. So go for it.
I want to see you weeping when your book is 3 months late. one of the things that came up on, I mean, Zach may be planning on saying this himself, but I'll do it for him. One of the things that came up in the Twitter conversations and the forum conversations about the Anime Encyclopedia, Helen, was the review of Clannad. Lots of arguing about whether or not you were going off the deep end on that one. I should say the Clannad review is basically all Helen's work.
And I don't think I was going off the deep end at all.
I don't think you were at all. I think really? It was a fantastic review. I loved every word of it. And I was very... For those that don't know the Clannad review, it engages with something that comes up in our thematic entry on everyday anime, which is that there are so many anime about schools and everyday life, but the concept in anime of the everyday is itself hyper-real and is itself a fantasy. The Clannad entry kind of deals with that in a great way, in a very provocative way. And I think it's going to send people to the everyday anime entry and seriously consider, you know, the way that schools and the way that young love is depicted in high school anime. So I think it's a great entry. I'm very pleased with it. And yes, Helen does say it will rot your brain and make you weep with nostalgia for something you never had. If I was a producer, I'd be happy to have that on the box.
And if I was reading it, I hope that it would make me think, well, is she talking out of her backside or is there something in this? And go and watch it.
I think it's certainly it's a review that has a position, but it's a position that invites you to engage with. I don't think it's a position that makes you think you're an idiot.
Yeah.
I one thing that we have always done is we have respected the intelligence of all our readers. And sometimes when you read,
except that guy in the
well, fair enough. No, we would respect his intelligence when he displayed it.
Yeah.
But we've gone from the baseline that all our readers are engaged, intelligent human beings. And sometimes they make us question that, but most of the time we get really good discussion and debate from our readers, and quite a lot of them have input into the book. You know, we set ourselves up. We say, if you find what you think is an error, let us know. And if it's an error, we'll correct it. And you know, people have given us great feedback.
we have changed our perspective on some things as well over time. I mean, every now and then there'll be an entry or a show that I will rewatch or review, and I'll look at the Anime Encyclopedia entry and see if I feel it's relevant. I mean, we are very, very cruel to a show called The Gigolo, for example. I actually found a VHS of it a while ago and watched it again, and it's nowhere near as bad as some of the hentai we watch today. But it's just the Gigolo has become for us this kind of benchmark of awfulness, because at the time it was the worst thing that we'd seen. We've seen a lot worse since then, though.
Well, and again, with hentai, you have to define worse. I mean, we've seen stuff that's much nastier, but it's still hard to find stuff that is actually more inept.
Right. Well, I mean, going back to your earlier metaphor, if you're Indiana Jones, it would occur to me that the porn is the boulder, right? So, like, when you're producing
fan artist, if you please, Helen McCarthy in a hat outrunning a boulder made of porn.
Right.
Actually, in some ways, maybe the porn is the ark.
Sure, right. Well, so, but I mean, so obviously it was a conscious decision to include...
I will eat your face.
Well, obviously it was a conscious decision to include hentai.
Yes.
Most people, I guess...
We argue about that a lot as well.
I'm sure.
Every time a new... Oh, sorry. Do you want to carry asking the questions?
I would love to. If the book... You know, if you had an encyclopedia of film that included pornographic film, I mean, I would imagine it would be a huge point of contention, and then the book would be relabeled as an encyclopedia of porn that happened to also include regular movies, just because it's going to draw so much attention. How did you come to that conclusion? Like, was it basically... This is a part of it, and by ignoring it, we're not doing our jobs. Is that effectively the argument there?
That's certainly part of it, Zach. I mean, don't forget we'd done the Erotic Anime Movie Guide in 1998, so we were aware of what was there. And I saw Justin, in fact, on Answer Man this very week, saying that, you know, hentai in the 1990s was a huge part of the foreign anime business, which it isn't really anymore because of the nature of the business has changed. I was very keen to make it clear to the apologists for anime, who said it was, you know, for grown-ups, that so much of it was supported on a foundation of pornography and hentai and horror. You know, Urotsuki Dōji paid for a dozen different anime to be released in the United Kingdom. I think it's worth including that. I actually wish that the Hollywood film industry was assessed in tandem with, you know, the porn industry, to show just how much of the filmmaking industry is below the line, shall we say. I think Ramon Lobato wrote a book about informal economies of cinema very recently, and he said it was something like 80% of American filmmaking is not part of the cinema world.
Right.
You know, it goes straight to video, it goes online, or it's pornography that no one sees, or it's, you know, some kind of niche that avoids television. And I think that's fascinating. And I think it would be a contentious subject, but wouldn't it be interesting if someone did an Encyclopedia of American Film that also included all that?
Well, it'd be a big book.
It would be a big book.
Might be as big as the Anime Encyclopedia.
Maybe.
But it certainly is a more honest way of looking at a medium, I think, of saying that this medium actually does everything. So why do we pretend that there are bits of it that don't exist or that can't be considered in the same way? I mean, half an hour of animated entertainment to the buyer is just about what he wants. It's not qualitatively different. Because he happens to want pornography rather than a robot adventure.
I mean, but you are right, Zach. We are being deliberately provocative with it. And every time we do an update, we do sit down and have the conversation, shall we take hentai out? There is an opportunity there to hive it off into its own little book. And every time, I mean, we've had this conversation twice now, and we've almost done it. We've almost said, okay, we're going to move it off, but we're not quite sure where to draw the line. Certainly with pornography, you know, when does it stop becoming, you know, mildly erotic and actually become pornographic? It's a very difficult line to draw. And also, I personally love having the whole thing there, the entire industry, particularly when so many well-known companies, if you dig through their umbrella corporations and their satellites, you discover that they themselves also have porno divisions.
Although what hiving it off would allow us to do would be to highlight not only those connections and those companies and maybe do thematic essays in the area of pornography. Be fun. But also to highlight some of the people involved who are actually filmmakers trying to do a decent job, often under a pseudonym, usually on next to no money, on awful timescales, like most animators everywhere. I mean, look at Ken Reicher. Ken Reicher is one of my favourite unsung stars in the encyclopedia. He directs an awful lot of porn. He always does his best to actually make it have a story and something vaguely resembling characters and deliver something like entertainment value. And he's just, you know, I think he's an unsung hero. The medium that he's working in is probably one of the more successful mediums in anime, I would imagine. I have no data to support this, but it wouldn't surprise me to know that he sells more of his tapes than some of those 1,800-person niche titles Jonathan's talking about.
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. You know, the industry is in a really strange place right now. So hentai especially is a... That is a section of the industry, as you mentioned, that has suffered a lot in recent years. Like it barely exists anymore.
There's still quite a lot of material to be plowed through, as I can verify.
Well, that's true, but you guys, I'm sure you guys have noticed that the business model has shifted now to censored television broadcasts, and then they sell the uncensored Blu-ray, and that's how they get people in the store because there's nipples on the Blu-ray and there's no nipples on the ATX broadcast or whatever.
Yeah.
So. You know, that's kind of the new thing. And that stuff, and we've actually seen arguments in the forums where people are saying they prefer this to straight-up hentai. They prefer ecchi anime to straight-up hentai because the animation budget will be bigger, the story will be a focus, like, it will be better than porn, and they can still get off to it because it has what they want. So that's really upended the hentai industry, from what I understand.
Yeah.
That's a new thing.
But also it's a distribution matter because, as Justin was saying in his column this week, most of the hentai in America was distributed through sex shops.
Mm-hmm.
Sex shops themselves are in decline because everyone's getting all their porn from the internet.
Right.
Not everyone, obviously, you know, but most people.
Yeah, right, exactly. Okay, so let's go ahead and get to these Twitter questions. Andrea Paplu asks, what unlicensed titles in the encyclopedia do you want to see English releases of?
I would like to see an English language release of Momotaro's Divine Sea Warriors. And I'm not being deliberately difficult. It has just come out in Blu-ray in Japan.
Okay.
So there is an opportunity there for someone to subtitle it and do a very nice commentary track and scare people with Japanese propaganda from 1945.
I'd like to see an English language release of almost anything made before 1945. You know, really, there is so much good material out there and so little of it has been released that you could virtually pick five titles at random and you'd have a wonderful addition to the catalogue.
All right. VZMK2 wants to know what your favorite episode of Cream Lemon is.
I like Pop Chaser. Yeah. I've always been fond of Pop Chaser.
Isn't that the only one?
I do not have a favorite episode because I think it's all equally horrible.
Oh, come on. Pop Chaser was kind of sweet. It was, you know, the lesbian one.
Right.
You say you know the lesbian one, like I would know that.
Yeah.
Cream Lemon is Helen's part of the encyclopedia. I try not to go there.
She's insinuating that you're some kind of degenerate. That's what.
Well, everyone knows that.
Yeah.
Okay. Vinny of AGC wants to know if the sheer amount of television, you mentioned it's gone down a little bit, has the sheer amount of television being produced has affected the amount of work the book is per entry.
Per entry, no, you still do the same amount of work per entry. You still have to do the same level of research. You might have to watch more for a successful show than for a less successful show. Obviously, watching a film takes less time than trying to watch enough of a TV series to get a handle on it. But the volume of work is about the same.
Rainbow War 71 wants to know if the Science Fiction Encyclopedia was influential on the design of the Anime Encyclopedia.
That's a reference to my role as a contributing editor on the Science Fiction Encyclopedia, which is an online and free resource and has about 100,000 words in there about Chinese and Japanese science fiction, including anime. I do have done a few anime entries for them. And the truth is, no, the Science Fiction Encyclopedia has not been an influence because I only started working for them in 2011 and... They have a very particular kind of style and a very particular way of approaching their material. So you can actually read, for example, the Gunbuster entry that I wrote for the Science Fiction Encyclopedia, and you'll see it's very different from the Gunbuster entry that I wrote for the Anime Encyclopedia. I would like the Science Fiction Encyclopedia to have an influence on the Anime Encyclopedia, because the way it monetizes is very different. The Science Fiction Encyclopedia is not a book, it's a service. And so the people who work on it are paid a stipend to update it and to continue to expand it.
Oh, heaven.
Yeah. And obviously I would very much like that if the Anime Encyclopedia were an ongoing affair and I could just dedicate more time to it. But at the moment, the Anime Encyclopedia is a book. So I can't do that. But, you know, you never know. One day an eccentric millionaire will turn up and give us loads of money to just, you know, to maintain a permanent rolling service. And then there'll be trouble.
Won't there just?
Right. He was a two-part question. The second part was, are you considering putting the Anime Encyclopedia online in the same fashion?
Not unless someone pays us.
Right.
Yep.
That's the question. How will someone pay? And the thing is the Science Fiction Encyclopedia is an absolutely fantastic resource, but it's being paid for by Gallant, by a publisher which uses it as a gateway to an entire world of Kindle books that you can buy from them. And they regard it as a reasonable investment. Although if they pulled the plug, you know, who knows what would happen. And it's the same with that. If it were an online resource, how would we get paid? I mean, as it is, I don't know if Helen will let me say what our advance for this book was, but it wasn't a lot of money.
It certainly wasn't a lot of money.
We are paid basically a penny a page to write this book. So it's not a huge amount of cash. And although the first edition and the second edition made back their advance and made us some money, and basically, as far as I'm concerned, paid me minimum wage for the time that I put in, which was all I was expecting, so I'm quite happy with that. And I hope the third edition will do the same thing. But this is certainly not something that I'm not talking to you from my yacht when I tell you this. It's not a particularly well-paid endeavor. And if it were online and given away for free, then it would not be paid at all. And unless someone found a way of making that happen, I don't see it happening.
Yeah. I mean, also, of course, it's now a unique thing. It is still a physical book. It's a Kindle book now, which would make a wonderful basis for an online resource if we ever got to that stage. But it, one of its unique selling points is that it is still a book. It still stands on those values. To take it online would be such a huge endeavor and such a huge shift. It would be coming into a very, very crowded market, competing against lots of the sources that have mined it for the past 15 years. It would also need serious investment. And, of course, Jonathan and I both have to be kept in the manner to which we expect to be accustomed.
I want caviar.
Well,
trailer.
Your own trailer. Wow, you have big ambitions. I just like an updated computer and more chocolate, please.
Okay. T. Guycott asks, what sort of difficulty is there when creating entries and summaries for the most obscure or inaccessible anime titles out there?
I would point out, firstly, that obscure is a movable feast. Mm. Helen mentioned the Shadow Staff, for example, which is a group of animators who made instructional cartoons for the Japanese Army and the Japanese Navy. In fact, they supposedly made a cartoon that instructed the pilots who attacked Pearl Harbor how to attack Pearl Harbor. They were not credited on it, and all of their work was destroyed in 1945 by the Japanese. And anything the Japanese missed, the Americans burned as well. As a result, it's so obscure that no one has seen it. And so I had to piece together stuff from people's memoirs and little fragments, like what was written on the boxes before they were destroyed. And so it's very, you know, that's pretty obscure. And so the most obscure stuff is not only something I haven't seen, it's something that no one's seen. Something like The King's Tale, for example, which was destroyed by the studio that made it. Or Cool Ship, which is the first erotic anime, which was believed destroyed but has since been uncovered in Tokyo, although I haven't seen it myself. So, you know, that's really obscure. The other thing to bear in mind, and this is something of a first world problem, I'll admit, but once we write about it, it's not obscure anymore. Mm-hmm. And this can become a big issue, because we'll fight and scrape and go on these voyages of discovery and get incredibly excited about something. When the first edition was published, there were 300 titles in there that had never been discussed in the English language before. Of course, now everyone knows about them. They may not have seen them, but though it gets scraped and it gets used, and it's part of our job to be ripped off. It's part of our job to be cited and to be read, and so we can't complain about the fact that the things that we discover are things that 5 years later everybody thinks everyone's already known. I'm sure that's not what the questioner meant, but that is a problem for me. It's something I have to deal with on a regular basis, that I will put weeks of work into some kind of new discovery, and then it's yesterday's news.
Mm-hmm. Well, luckily we are both historians, and as historians, that's what you expect.
Yeah, that's
you
what
expect
you want,
to
actually.
Make a discovery. Yeah, you put your little bit into the wall, and then somebody comes and walks all over you as they build the next bit, and that's fine. There are no particular difficulties in researching obscure anime per se. The difficulty is in finding out about it in the first place. Once you know it exists, you just get in there and refuse to stop.
Mm-hmm. Okay, Invalid Name asks, now that the Anime Encyclopedia is an ebook, how often and for how long do you think you'll send out electronic updates?
See Jonathan's earlier answer on how often
yes,
are we going to get paid
I think
for it.
We've probably covered that. I mean, the real issue here is, for me, the paper book. We have to protect the integrity of the paper book.
Right.
It has to have page numbers that people can point to and cite. I know that half the reviewers in the world don't think they'll ever be citing it, but those reviewers that do want to cite it need to know what the page number is. So we can't just shove new entries in and change the pagination, because that ruins the index, which some guy in India has spent 3 weeks writing.
Right.
Probably giving away as a PDF as we speak.
Yes, well, let's hope not. Let's not slander the people who worked on the book. Oh, too late. I refer the honourable gentleman to my earlier answer about who's going to pay for it, and that's the problem. It's a book, not a service. I would very much like it to be a service, and if anyone listening has got a few million,
Japanese cultural foundations, major universities, even film studios,
pornographers.
We're very Catholic.
Dog food manufacturers, we'll take anything.
we'll talk to anybody.
Right, okay. All right, and to wrap up here, Vinny of AGC asks, what is the worst thing you've seen since the second edition of the Encyclopedia?
The worst thing I've seen since the second edition of the Encyclopedia?
You mentioned
it's got to be dog
earlier.
And scissors for me, I think.
Dog and scissors, holy shit, yeah. Oh, God.
It was one of the pornographic run that starts with Princess. There's a whole pile of pornography
something that
is something or other, or Knight. There's a whole run of pornography that tries to pretend it's Princess Knight.
Mm.
And there was one, I forget the title, because mercifully I do forget these things, where a warrior is taken prisoner and all that. It's amazing. Although these women are always incredibly effective warriors, despite the fact that they wear next to nothing and don't carry anything heavier than a handbag, they're always taken prisoner incredibly easily. And when they're taken prisoner, it takes absolutely no time to break their resistance at all. I don't know how the armies of fantasy cope. But this was a particularly nasty thing involving purple pig men.
Oh,
I don't have nightmares about it, but I don't really, that's where it becomes a job. That's where you turn on the computer and you think, okay, time to do some porn.
Helen's reminded me of the kind of shorthand that we had when we were working on this, where we kind of check in with each other every now and then to find out who was where. And I get an answer back like, I'm halfway through the dragons. Or, I'm in the princesses, or I'm up to sin, because there are certain words which just repeat and repeat and repeat in the titles, and you can spend a week doing nothing but dragon this and dragon that.
Yeah.
And every now and then, and dragon was one of them, and princess was another. And there's one or two words that just kind of pop up, and you think, oh, here we go, sexy something else.
There's lots of Valkyries, too, and Norse mythology should really sue anime, certainly anime porn, because Valkyries, trust me, they ain't what they used to be in Odin's day.
Okay, well, that wraps us up. It has been an honor and a pleasure talking to both of you. Thank you so much for coming on and doing the show. The book is available now, both electronically and in enormous doorstop versions. You can get it on Amazon from Stonebridge Press. Guys, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Well, thank you very much for having us. And may I do a quick plug? If anyone does go out and buy The Doorstop, and please do, because we absolutely love it, I'll be at least 3 conventions in America this spring, early summer, to sign it. If you're coming along to Anime North or Anime Central or ACON, I'll be right there and you can drop the thing on the table in front of me. Hopefully it won't crack and I'll sign it for you.
Okay.
And I'll be hiding somewhere in Europe or Asia like a ninja, and you'll have to track me down and say the magic word to get me to sign it.
Right.
And the magic word is, here's $2 million, go and make the Anime Encyclopedia into a service.
Right. Okay, that's our show. Huge thanks to Helen and Jonathan for stopping by. The theme song is Bucharest. It's by the band The New Division. You can check them out at newdivisionmusic.com. Don't forget, subscribe to us on iTunes. Leave us a rating or review. We'd really appreciate it. And we'll see you all next week.